We, you know, Bruce invited us to provide a little comic relief for 45 minutes, and we discovered he cut it to 40.
That just means you have to talk faster.
Our topic is ensuring your LIS's future, and as I think most of you know, that the average longevity of a laboratory information system in the hospitals and laboratories today is about 65 years, or is it 70 years?
But I installed that one. So.
Oh, you got that one? Right. Actually, it's one, Al. About how many years is it? 10? Over 10.
Yeah, it's actually, I just finished a survey. There's 1,800 hospitals over 300 beds that have had their LIS system installed for over 13 years.
So you'll be sticking with, if you have a system, you'll probably have it around for a long time. And if you're getting a new one, you'll probably have it around for a long time, dealing with the same vendor and hopefully upgrades to the system. So ensuring your LIS's future, I think, is an important topic.
Yeah, you know, when Bruce asked us to come present, he said we had to come up and entertain the organization for, as I said, 45 minutes. And I was perfectly willing to do that. I brought my didn't bring my banjo, but at least brought the appropriate accoutrements. But Dennis said, if I did this, I had to leave my snake oil at home. So.
That's right. Well, you may have noticed that for the second consecutive year, we did not bring our banjos. And I don't hear any groans of disappointment, so obviously that was the proper decision.
I think we made the right choice there, yes.
So the topics we're going to cover are negotiating long-term vendor contracts. Hopefully it's something you can sign and put away. How you go about vendoring some of the vendor standard terms. We're talking about risk-based contracts.
Yes.
Service level agreements.
Yep.
Okay. Updates, upgrades, data access and conversion, integration and interfaces, and the traditional versus the ASP application server provider agreements. Now, we recognize there are different objectives, and you know, as we go through this presentation, if we make any comments with regard to issues with vendor contracts, we'd like to say that for the vendors in the audience, we are not talking about your firm. We're talking about your competitors.
It's only your competitors to worry about, right?
So let's talk a little bit, and I'll take this side of the user. In general, the kinds of objectives that the user has, first of all, is to pay a fair price. By a fair price, I mean low enough so that your vendor can continue to stay in business. That would be a fair price. To get an accurate and a complete project plan, which is interesting because vendors typically have a project plan that reflects their boilerplate approach, but very rarely is that project plan converted and modified to reflect the particular instance of the particular laboratory or hospital in which the system is going to be installed. And there's a lot of other things that are going on that need to be included. But that's another user objective, to get dedicated trained resources applied to their installation from the vendor. Quick story, we had a client one time with a vendor, and they went to training class to discover their installer was in class with them. And it was not in the top 10% of the students. Important thing. Provide excellent service levels to install the system on time and to protect against any misspeakings that a vendor might have said prior to the contract. So now Hal's going to take the other side of the coin. What is it that?
Yeah, obviously the vendor wants to make as much money as they can out of that particular contract with as few resources as they have to apply. They want to ensure that the hospital meets its staffing requirements, because that's one of the key things that we've seen, is hospitals go in not understanding the amount of resources that it takes on their behalf to have a successful implementation.
Right.
And that really needs to be understood up front in the process.
There's a lot of instances of the phantom project team. For as I look out here, I say, well, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 people. Wow, what a project team. Turns out that all of you have other jobs that are keeping you busy full time. It's not a real project team.
And obviously, in terms of service levels, they don't want to have to staff so that there's one customer service person for every client. They want to basically attempt to maximize as few resources as they can to maintain an adequate service level. And they also don't want any penalties. Okay, they want, hey, here it is. They don't even want to warrant that they have a product that actually does anything. So, but in reality, In order to have a long-term relationship with a vendor, what you need to do is come to a common ground that's somewhere between the two of those.
And it is a two-way street, negotiating the contract. I mean, in terms of concessions and things you want to do, it's not just the vendor. Very often it's the laboratory or the customer that's making requests for concessions and so forth. So with regard to some of the success factors, I think it's important to understand the fact that you're going to have a long-term partnership, whether it's 65 years or over 10, with the same vendor and the same system, albeit upgraded. It's important to understand the vendor's culture. One approach to that is, before signing a contract, is go visit the corporate headquarters of the vendor you're going to be dealing with. Hal and I often say, if you go there and discover they're operating out of a tent, it's probably not a good sign.
Yeah, it really isn't a contract. It really is a relationship that you need to start developing with that vendor. And that happens really early on in the process.
You need to understand what your expectations are, but also to be flexible. When you are working in a contract, you need to have some control over how you're going to do that and your project team. And also make it clear that your vendor is going to be dealing with certain people, either the designated negotiator or someone on your negotiating team, and not to go around the back door to anybody else.
Yeah, you've got to have some way to preempt what I call the vendor shenanigans, right? Going around the project team and going to one of the EIEIO people. And the thing is to get the whole organization on the same page, so that if somebody goes to the CFO says, I can't do anything about it, go back to the project team. It also gives you a clear understanding of perhaps how that vendor's corporate culture works, if they're willing to try to preempt the processes that you've put into place. One of the things that we think is very important when you start a negotiation process, this has to be a two-way street, and that the things that are mandatory from both parties really need to be understood up front. But on the same time, what's most important is that the people who are doing the negotiations have to be sole source. So both on the side of the vendor and on the side of the user who's negotiating it. One common point of access, Dennis and I both have this same comment that loose lips cost money. So you want to make sure you have multiple people talking to the vendor, disclosing things that are going on within the organization. And obviously the vendor is going to try to get around that and do that. You want to have a negotiating team that understands what it is you're trying to accomplish early on and make them a cohesive organization that goes through it. And you have to be realistic about what you can do and what you can't do in the process. You really want to define a methodology of negotiation so that it is non-adversarial.
Speaking of that, do you happen to have a copy of the vendor contract?
Yeah, I think I brought one with me. Hang on here.
I think I see it there.
There it is.
Is that it?
This is it.
Let me have the whole thing.
It was about 49 pages.
You got it?
I got it right here.
So here's this is the standard vendor contract right here. That's an over-exaggeration, perhaps, but this cartoon pretty much says something. We'll get back to that. That was extreme, and I probably will need a bodyguard leaving later. I want to talk a little bit about contract negotiation basics. A couple of premises. The worst time to negotiate a contract is clearly during contract negotiations. Your leverage by that time with the vendor is pretty minimal. The best time actually to negotiate the contract is when you send out your initial request for information, request for proposal, request for price quotation, in which you state contractual issues that are important to you very specifically and ask the vendor's position on those contractual issues. At a minimum, you know where they stand and you know what you may have to do when you go into negotiations. And it also gives your vendor a heads up with regard to how they will need to deal with you in the contract. The second premise, despite what I just did, is that the vendor standing contract definitely has value. It's a good basis, usually is a very good basis to start, particularly if the vendor's care is covered, the contract covers things that are important, like acceptance, like support, like response times, and so forth, then at least you have a framework to begin your negotiations to perhaps change what it says in those sections, but at least those sections are there. And recently, and I think Hal will agree, for the most part, the vendor contracts, standard contracts that we're seeing now are pretty good in that they cover the range of things that are important, although what they specifically say in those sections may need to be modified and usually does.
And I think most important is don't believe the vendor that says this contract can't be changed. Any vendor contract can be changed, even the stuff in bold.
Yes, and the stuff in, you know what the stuff in bold always says? The stuff in bold says there's no guarantee or warranty that anything in this contract has any usability, suitability whatsoever for every purpose.
Yeah, I wouldn't even warrant that it's an LIS system.
And at least it should say, except that the software will run on the hardware that we're providing. But it doesn't. There's no responsibility or warranty for anything, suitability or purpose. Anyway, that's usually in bold. The contract should cover the entire system. That is the software, the hardware, the installation, and the support. Even if, in some cases, there's subcontract for certain components of the system, the primary vendor should assume responsibility for that to avoid the finger pointing. And last but not least, this isn't a contest. This is a long-term relationship. The contract, in the end, has to be fair. And I think the vendors are certainly prepared to protect themselves. You need to protect yourselves, and at the end, there ought to be a contract that you're both comfortable with, or reasonably comfortable with, you put away, and you never take it out again.
Yep. I think one of the other things that's important is, in terms of warranties and performance, don't just believe what the sales guy says. Yeah, the system will be up, it'll have a good response time. You want to have an acceptance criteria that meets what it is you're trying to acquire. If you're trying to buy an LIS system that will handle 600 workstations, you want to make darn sure that it doesn't have 27-minute response time. And the vendor said, well, I didn't agree to any response time criteria, so ergo, you have to accept the system. Or you accept the system, you never accept the system, but you have to pay for support even though you don't use it. So these things have to be clear up front. I think you also always have to have a backup plan. Okay, there's got to be compromises, but in the end run, the reality is if you can't come to an agreement, it's much easier to walk away from an engagement than it is have a divorce later on.
Yeah, and I think the acceptance criterion is particularly important. A lot of the acceptance criterion that you'll see typically are function and feature, sometimes performance, more rarely uptime, and very rarely backup and recovery. And I think it's important before accepting a system that your enterprise is going to be dependent upon, that somewhere along the line, before you start running it operationally, you know and you understand how to fix it if suddenly smoke comes out of the machine. And that should be done with the vendor before you go operational. It should be part of your acceptance that says, we did backup and recovery, somebody pulled the plug, we did the backup and recovery, we know how to do it, and in fact, it recovered our data, and it works again. As far as performance, performance standards, building in the fact, particularly this is a long-term agreement, build in the fact that we hope and you expect that your laboratory workload volume will grow and that the system should be designed to meet that growth and be expandable to cover that and to understand that the conditions under which performance may be degraded. If you grow, suddenly have grown 100%, at that point in time you may need another system, but you need to understand in advance somewhat about what the performance characteristics look like. And of course, the support issues for how much coverage there is, what kind of response, what can you do for escalation, and also, now it's not as important today as it used to be, but if in the event that you cannot get support from your original vendor, the ability to use third-party companies to provide you that support.
Okay. Yeah, I think, and as far as the legal stuff, don't let your pathologist think he's an attorney because he isn't. Leave that stuff to the attorneys.
Yeah, and usually what we suggest is go through the contract to be sure that the acceptance, the support, all of the things that are important to the operation and success of the system have been reviewed and negotiated before you give it to the attorneys. Let the attorneys worry about the legalistic aspects, because most attorneys that I know don't understand laboratory information systems specifically. They may understand the legal aspects of a contract, but very few really understand what is involved in a good systems contract.
What we'd like to talk about next is maybe an alternative approach to contract for a system. This is something I'm seeing several of my clients that have actually done in the past couple of years. It's an approach that says, rather than just contracting for a product, I contract for an outcome. It's been around for a long time in governmental contracts, where rather than just buying a system, what you have is a true alliance between the vendor and the buyer that has specific objectives based upon financial return on investment, implementation goals, time frames, benchmarks that can be adequately measured with appropriate metrics. And it also allows for both the vendor and the user to share in the benefits. And we'll talk a bit later. I have actually had one client that actually paid their vendor three times the list price for their software and was very happy to have done that.
I see smiling vendors out there.
Yes. Any vendors? Vendors out there? Yes, okay. And it's also a way that it's a way to develop a long-term relationship that really is. It goes on for a long time. So, what is it? It's not a method just to put a penalty clause in your contract. You can do that with many other ways. And it may not be applicable to all situations in all contracts. But I think the key component is there has to be a commitment on both parties. It has to be a mission-critical application, such as an LIS for a large IDN, that has the backup of the organization for the resources that the user has to apply to meet the criteria, as well as the vendor's commitment to put the appropriate resources in. It also provides some incentives for both organizations. I think at the same time that, it's a methodology to ensure that return on investment can be reached. It's a methodology to ensure that your system gets installed on time. But it may actually cost you more in the front end to get it happening, because you may have to put more resources to get it done. So I'll go to the next slide. Okay. The types of risk-based contracting are, one is the ultimate, where you outsource everything to a vendor, and they do it all. Not typical in the LIS arena, although there have been some examples in Cincinnati and a few other places where they actually have outsourced the entire lab to a third party to do it. Development partner agreements, where you are a beta site to help customize and develop a product for a vendor that hasn't had a product in that arena before, where there's risk inherent on both sides. Ones that are tied to achieving milestones. I will get my lab up and running by such and such a date. Or those that are tied to performances or benefit-based, or combinations of any of them. All sorts of different ways to do it. The real issue is many healthcare organizations are leery about paying more than the list price for a product. And I think what you have to understand is where the motivation comes from. If a vendor can say, I can really improve your turnaround time for your stats and save you $2 million in the first 2 years, and is willing to put their money where their claims are, then it might be worth entering into an agreement that contractually commits both you and the vendor to meet those objectives by putting the appropriate resources and technologies in place. So let's take a look at a couple of examples. This is pretty basic. The vendor says, I will install my system in 6 months, and there are multiple milestones. I'll install the software. I'll do this. This pretty well happens in most contracts today. There's milestones that are met. Vendors get paid. This may not be considered a true risk-based contract, but it's in the same realm. But when we go into things where it makes it risk is if the vendor misses a milestone, there may be penalties involved, okay, if it's due to the vendor. The issue is, how do I really accurately measure and define what constitutes the fault of the vendor or the fault of the user. That's the hard part in all these contracts. I think the most important area is improved service levels. I worked with one client 2 years ago that purchased a enterprise-wide transcription system that served radiology and pathology for four hospitals, four organizations. The vendor claimed that they would be able to reduce the total transcriptionist pool by three FTEs and improve turnaround time by 4 hours, and agreed to a contract that said they would, in fact, contract for that. And if they didn't meet those milestones, there would be a percentage of reduction in what the user actually paid for the contract for the system. In reality, what happened was at the end of the implementation, a year later, they had actually saved seven FTEs, and the turnaround time was down to 2.5 hours. Okay, and that was the site that gladly paid the vendor 300% of the list price of the software.
Gladly.
Gladly paid. Gladly paid. Okay. Now, there was another site that basically said, I can go in, I can reduce your turnaround time. Am I off one here? Okay.
No.
Yeah, risk reward. Let's go back one. Yeah. Where I will actually reduce one FTE due to being able to do auto verification. And then they decided on a, they did a survey beforehand and determined that 50% of all the results being auto released was an appropriate metric that could be easily measured, that they could save one FTE in the process. And a part of the contract price, and there were many of these milestones and ROI benefits that were in the contract, was that they would meet this metric. In reality, they actually ended up releasing 70% of all of the results through AutoVerify. However, shame on that site, they didn't reduce one FTE, although they could have. So, but they still ended up gladly paying the vendor because the turnaround time was substantially improved.
Is that the case where the person was a cousin to the CEO?
No, it was just shame on that customer, that's all I can say. This is, I think, when you look at risk-based contracting, it may not be for the entire system as a whole. It may be for components of it. And there's various touch points in negotiating a contract that provides for these kinds of incentives on both sides of the table. Okay, it's not for everybody. Not all the vendors out there are willing to do this. Those who are willing to do this, I think I congratulate them for being brave enough to say if my salespeople are willing to go out and do a cost-benefit analysis, I'm willing to back it up contractually and say my system really will do what that sales guy said it would do. It's a real opportunity to gain closure quickly. It's a real opportunity to really gain a community within your organization of resources that are working together towards a common goal. Okay.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues, too, is that usually when you're getting to do a contract, you're anxious to get going, you're anxious to get the system implemented, to introduce the risk aspect of it. Now says not only do you have to determine, you know, what the risk factors are, what the penalties are, what the bonuses are, which also adds to the time of trying to get a contract. So as Hal says, it's not for everyone, but it can generate significant benefits both to the hospital, the lab, and to the vendor if properly done.
I think the message to take home with you is that, you know, with the increasing pressure on the healthcare dollar, more hospitals may agree to share benefits if the vendor truly can't exceed expectations. It sure beats the alternative, a costly failure, where you're stuck with paying for a system that doesn't work with no recourse.
So it was sort of risky of you to wear that hat.
I don't know. It's better than me playing my banjo, though, right?
So let's talk a little bit about updates and upgrades, which sometimes turn out to be pretty sticky issues. For example, when you look at the timing, for example, of an update or an upgrade, lots of times the labs are not really ready to do the upgrade, or to go to the next version, whereas the vendor obviously would like to move as many people onto the common version as they possibly can from a support standpoint. So I think one of the questions that comes up and should come up in terms of a long-term relationship is, how much time do I have, or how many versions behind can I choose to be if I so choose to do it? Another aspect of that is with regard to the monthly support costs and how do you control that? And when does support go into effect? I've seen contracts that say you start paying support when we deliver software. When the software is delivered, you're getting absolutely no utility out of it, and it would seem a much more reasonable time to start support would be actually when you're using the system in an operational setting. And there's things you can do in between, but certainly that's a point of negotiation, is when do the support payments and when should they go into effect?
Yeah, I think an important thing to understand up front, different vendors have different approaches. Some will say, oh, all the updates and upgrades are free, but all you have to do is pay me $27 million to install them. I think it's important to understand what is included and whether or not you're going to be faced with just a pure time and materials implementation fee, which could be open-ended, or you can pre-negotiate a fixed fee for upgrades and updates up front. Very important component of understanding a long-term relationship with your customer, with your vendor.
And going to new versions and upgrades, this can be somewhat traumatic. For example, in this audience, how many people have converted from XP to Vista at this point?
A couple of brave souls, not many.
Not me either.
Not me either. No.
Very few. I mean, so you need to have some flexibility in when you do that. Another thing that's very useful with regard to updates and upgrades is to have periodic operational audits. And I think Hal and I are pretty much in agreement with the percentage of any installed system that is actually being utilized by a laboratory. In terms of capabilities, functions, and features, probably about 70%.
It's abysmally low.
That there's a lot of function, a lot of feature that's available in the system that for various reasons, having to get it implemented quickly and so on and so forth, transition, turnover, that the capabilities are forgotten and you're unaware that they're there. A periodic audit is part of the update, and planning is a very valuable thing. If the vendor solutions are too costly, I know Hal and Dr. Friedman have talked about SLAMs, supplemental lab,
AKA middleware now. Right?
Middleware,
yes.
To provide some alternatives to necessarily going to a vendor solution for an update. And another thing related to updates and upgrades is the leverage group. Leverage your user group and form coalitions with similar laboratories with regard to trying to get things on the vendor's plate to get developed. You can generate a lot of leverage. Lots of times what you'll hear, I'm not surprised if you're a lab and you go to your vendor and say, we want to do this thing, this little XYZ. And the vendor looks at it and says, you know, that's very nice, but we don't think anybody else is interested in that. That's very specific. We'll do it for you on a custom basis and so forth. And yet I think if you either work with your vendor more closely or with other laboratories, you may find that XYZ is really not as unique. If you look at a way to generalize that upward, you say, you know, if we build this capability, we can provide XYZ as a parameterized capability. And it doesn't have to be special. And everybody wins. The vendor wins because they've got more capability. You win because you get what you want, and it's not a custom.
Or you may be able to find a low-cost middleware solution,
at least
in the interim.
Touching on service level agreements, what kind of support, what kind of service levels can you expect, should you expect, and when do support fees start?
Well, obviously before the contract starts, right?
Ideally. No, well, actually, again, support fees should start, as I said earlier, when you begin getting operational utility out of the system. New releases, when do they come, how much do they cost? In a support setting, what sort of problem resolution process? What is it? How do you escalate? How do you get things done? Usually vendors are very, very good. If you have smoke and fire, they will come and they will put out the smoke and fire. If you have an issue that's affecting your business in some way, it depends. With regard to the agreements, they should have guaranteed renewal over a certain period of time. You should specify the coverage time, response times, and the availability. And an important one in the contract is the cost. After the first year, after the first term, how much flexibility are you going to allow the vendor in terms of increasing their support fees? Usually, we've seen the consumer price index maybe plus something, maybe
small just percentage.
Small percentage. But that should be in the contract. And finally, if there's a default on support, and most contracts are very rigid about you can't get other people to help, you should be able to have a provision where if you're not getting the support, company goes into bankruptcy, heaven forbid, you can get third parties to help support you in the interim.
I think one of the most important components, because eventually you may have to go away from that vendor, or that vendor may go away themselves. You need to make sure that you have access to the data that's in your system. It's your data. It's not the vendor's data. So one of the things you have to ensure in contracting for a new system is that you can have access to export that data without having to, one, pay the vendor a massive fee to do that for you, and number two, that you in fact do own your own data, number one. Number two, if you have an existing system and are going to try to migrate that system to a new system, there are now wonderful third-party tools that are out there to assist you in doing that migration. Some actually will actually go out and are able to analyze your database by actually looking at the database, creating the structure of the database, mapping it to another database, and then allowing you to write some rules to actually convert one form of data, which is information in one system, to information in another system, actually do some of the data conversion itself. I think Dr. Bayless talked a bit about that, some of the tools that are available, and other people have talked about that. Very important they understand the process that it's going to take you, one, to get the old data from your system into the new system, and at some point in the future to be able to get all your data out of your current system into some other system.
And also,
yeah, interfaces. This can be the thing that absolutely brings every implementation process to its knees. Everyone's talked about trying to develop standards. The reality is we're not there yet. It would be wonderful if we could just plug in an interface in it, like you plug in something new to your USB port. It's, aha, that's a XYZ vendor system, and I'll automatically implement the interface to it.
Yeah, this is a visual. Too many interfaces are like this.
Right.
Not like that.
I thought they were like this.
That too. Or that.
Take your choice. Okay. What we think needs to happen, and this is a call to the vendor community, become active in the standards-making process. Embrace standards. This is the only way that all the things that we've talked about in today and tomorrow and the day before could become a reality. We can't continue to have to spend $200,000 and 6 to 12 months worth of agony trying to get two systems to talk to each other. Okay.
So as we wrap up, we're going to talk a little bit about different types of models. The traditional model of acquiring and paying for a system, capital budget, yeah, fixed expense, no, we've got a little more. Having your computers on site, very maintenance intensive, you've got people, they've got people, versus the ASP, this is the application service provider, not the snake model.
You mean it's not the thing
ASP
that bit Cleopatra?
Not the thing that bit Cleopatra. Okay. In which, and this is sort of a remote services, remote hosting type of a model where it's an operations budget. The expense is variable depending on different algorithms. It could be volume-based. It could be user-based. The computers are off-site, typically backed up in a very secure, conceivably multiple locations. And the maintenance is all handled centrally. So that's something that goes away from a user standpoint, the maintenance issues and the computing hardware housing the computer. Pros and cons, like everything else. Typically, it's a lower upfront investment for the ASP, operating budget, which may be valuable. Theoretically, lower lifetime costs, although I'm not 100% convinced of that. Could be. You do risk share with the vendor. solving the skill shortage is, I think, particularly important. There are a lot of laboratories and hospitals that have difficulty maintaining and keeping good, qualified, knowledgeable LIS people, LIS managers.
Or especially database managers.
Database managers. That's a big component of it.
It
helps in that some of the administrative things are taken away. And as far as upgrades are concerned, that no longer becomes, no longer becomes your problem. It becomes a problem of the vendor to maintain the technology upgrades, and obviously require, as all systems will, conformance with all the regulations. Cons, it may be a generic solution, may not fit your particular lab. You know what we always say: labs are all the same, except for the differences.
Or except mine.
Yes. It having inadequate bandwidth to handle all the communications, inadequate reliability, pretty unusual. Security should be better. Reliability should be better, but possibility. Is there a risk in getting the actual savings? Yes. You probably will need a long-term contract in order to get the payback doing this. And this is sometimes a very important one, although I'm not sure it's real, and that is, quote, loss of control of the data. And then also vendor stability and longevity issues. Is this company operating their data center, the ASP center, out of a tent again?
And obviously, one of the other issues that we see driving the decision really comes from the top of the organization. Is the organization committed to a single vendor solution that says, I'm going to buy one solution, I don't care how good it is or how bad it is, but we shall buy XYZ's total information system for our hospital. The other, which is, it says, we'll allow the laboratory to become proactive in this process and acquire a best of breed solution. In either modality, okay, there are issues that relate to an LIS that's part of another system versus an LIS that is separate, where you have to worry about interface issues, integration issues, management control issues. And the real key is, if it's driven by IS, it's probably going to be out of your control anyway. That's the reality.
So in summary, and you should be very thankful you did not bring our banjos, because we would have had a little... But there are lots of approaches to long... I guess the main message is, it's going to be a long-term arrangement with whatever vendor you select, whatever system. And up front, there are things that you can do with regard to the agreements and protecting the ensuring the long-term longevity and ensuring good use over a long period of time, with regard to different types of agreements that we've talked about.
And I think the time is right to really look and consider risk-based agreements to help provide a true ROI, to help sell this solution to your CIOs and CFOs and CFO and CEOs and all the other EIEIO people in your organization.
And the last point sort of deals with some introspection. And that is to realistically assess your own situation in your own laboratory, your own hospital, your own facility, your confidence in the vendor, as well as your own organization's capabilities to do what needs to be done, and, quote, its will.
And most important, it's the willingness to change.
Willingness to change, the willingness to ante up what needs to be anteed up. And very often that's something that slips. And finally...
We're over. Thank you.